Okay, today is May 15th, 2010. Okay, you begin with homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Hey, good morning, everybody. Okay, so today we are returning to Sutta number 26 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This will be the second talk on Sutta number 26, the Arya Pariyesana Sutta, the Discourse on the Noble Search. Okay, so this discourse is concerned with the Buddha's quest for enlightenment. And we saw in the previous class how he left the household life thinking that it was futile to pursue things that are subject to birth, old age, sickness, and death, subject to sorrow, subject to defilement. And he went out in search of that which is unborn, unaging, not subject to illness, the deathless, the sorrowless, the undefiled, what he calls the supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Okay, then he goes to two teachers. First he goes to a teacher named Alara Kalama. Under him he learns the meditation practices that lead to the third, what is called the state of nothingness. The plane of nothingness. He realizes that this is not the state of liberation that he was seeking, so he leaves his first teacher. He continues seeking. He goes to another teacher named Udaka Ramaputta. He trains under Udaka Ramaputta, and he achieves the highest meditation in this system, which is called the base of neither perception nor non-perception. Then he realizes that this state doesn't lead to enlightenment or to nibbana. And so he leaves his second teacher and he goes off on his own. And then we come to paragraph number 17, where he says, still in search of what is wholesome or what is good, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, he wandered by stages through the Magadhan country. The Magadhan country corresponds very closely to the modern Indian state called Bihar. Has anybody been to Bihar in India? You've been there. So this would be the state. Actually, the city of Rajagaha mentioned in the suttas is still in Bihar. It's called Rajgir. And the city of Gaya is still there. And of course, for Buddhists, the center of interest in the state of Bihar is Bodh Gaya, the place of the Buddha's enlightenment, which is there. Okay, so he goes wandering through the Magadhan country until eventually he arrives at a place called Urumela. And there he sees an agreeable piece of ground, a delightful grove with a clear flowing river, pleasing, pleasant smooth banks, and nearby a village for alms resort, which is very important because in order to get his food he has to go on alms route. Okay, so then he thinks this is an agreeable piece of ground and so on. This will serve for the striving of a young man intent on striving. And he sat down there thinking, this will serve for striving. Okay, then we have a very brief account of what happened. It seems almost as though he sits down and then he says, now we're in paragraph 18, then bhikkhus, being myself subject to birth, having understood the danger, the drawbacks, the defects in what is subject to birth, seeking the unborn supreme security from bondage, I attained the unborn supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being myself subject to aging, being myself subject to sickness, being myself subject to death, being myself subject to sorrow, being myself subject to defilement, having understood the danger in what is subject to defilement, seeking the undefiled supreme security from bondage, nibbana, I attained the undefiled supreme security from bondage, nibbana. The knowledge and vision arose in me. My deliverance or liberation is unshakable. This is my last birth. Now there is no renewal of being, no more repeated existence, no more round of rebirths. Okay, so if you read this, one gets the impression that the Buddha achieved enlightenment pretty quickly. You know, just one teacher didn't make it there, another teacher didn't make it there, finds a nice stretch of ground, sits down, and boom, there comes enlightenment. But to see what happened in the interval, we have to go to another sutta, which also gives a biographical sketch of the Buddha's search for enlightenment. This is sutta number 36, which I'm just going to go through a little bit quickly. Not the whole thing, but I'm going to start on page 335. And then we have paragraphs 13 to 16, you see the middle of the page. They're abridged because they repeat everything that's said in sutta number 26 from the point where the Buddha as a young man with black-haired young man. In the prime of life, he leaves the household life, then all of his seeking up to the point where he finds that a pleasant piece of ground, and he sits down there thinking, this will serve for striving. Okay, now we come to a passage. It strikes me, this is my own opinion, that this passage seems to have gotten put into the sutta out of the proper order. It seems to me that in the course of oral transmission, the proper sequence got juggled up. And you'll see why when we go through it. Okay, so now he thinks, these three similes occurred to me spontaneously, never heard before. Suppose there were a wet, sappy piece of wood lying in water, and a man came with an upper fire stick, thinking, I shall light a fire, I shall produce heat. you know, ancient India, in fact, even up and through countries of Southern Asia, right up to fairly recent times, to light, start a fire, you don't take out a pack of matches or a, they call it a cigarette lighter and snap it to make a fire. But to get a fire, you have to use these fire sticks. In Taiwan, do they use fire sticks still? No. Cigarette lighters. But it's the same principle. You have one kind of stick generates a spark. Okay, so he has a wet piece of wood lying in water, and he comes with an upper fire stick, and he thinks to make a fire. So could he produce heat and start a fire using the fire stick together with a wet, sappy piece of wood lying in water? Okay, the answer is no. He'll only be wary and disappointed. Okay, so now the Buddha says, those recluses and Brahmins who do not live bodily withdrawn from sensual pleasures, in other words, they're fully indulging in sensual pleasures bodily, and they still have sensual desire, sensual thirst, and so on, in the mind. So it's not yet abandoned and suppressed. So if those good recluses and Brahmins feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, that means that they practice the extreme ascetic practices, like fasting for long periods, subjecting the body to the heat of the sun, sleeping on beds of thorns, and so on. They are incapable of knowledge and vision and supreme enlightenment. And if those good recluses and Brahmins do not feel these painful feelings due to the ascetic practices, they're still incapable of enlightenment. Okay, so the simile is that being involved physically in the enjoyment of sense pleasures, that is like the piece of wood being immersed in the water. And having the sensual craving in the mind, that is like the wood being wet on the inside. So you have the piece of wood in water, wet on the inside, you rub it, and you can't make a fire. Even though you rub very hard, that's like the ascetic practices, but the wood is wet on the outside, wet on the inside, so it won't make a fire. Okay, the second simile, here we have a wet, sappy piece of wood lying on dry land far from the water, and then the man comes with the fire stick thinking to make a fire. So can he make the fire? And then the answer is no, because it's a wet, sappy piece of wood. So even though it's lying on dry land, but inside it's still wet and sappy. So even if one rubs it, one can't make a fire. And so the Buddha says, this is like those recluses and Brahmins who live bodily withdrawn from sensual pleasures. They're not indulging in sensual pleasures physically, but they still have the sensual desire, sensual infatuation, sensual thirst, and so on, in their mind. And so this is like having the hindrance of sensual craving in the mind. So even if those ascetics and Brahmins subject themselves to the bitter practices, to the austere practices, they're not able to reach enlightenment. And if they don't subject themselves to the austere practices, they still can't reach enlightenment. Okay, so here, being withdrawn from sensual pleasures physically, that's like the wood outside of the water, removed from the water on dry land. But since the wood has the wetness inside, That is like having the sensual craving on the inside. So as long as you're still nurturing the sensual craving, even if one externally undertakes the ascetic practices, they won't bring enlightenment. Okay, then the third simile occurs to him. Suppose we have a dry piece of wood on dry land far from the water, and a man comes with the upper fire stick thinking, I shall light the fire, I shall produce heat. Can he produce the fire? And then the answer is yes, because it is a dry, sapless piece of wood on dry land far from water. So this is like those recluses and Brahmins who live bodily withdrawn from sensual pleasures. That is like the piece of wood being far from the water. And then their sensual desire and so on has been abandoned and suppressed internally. That is like the wood on the inside being dry. No sap on the inside. So even if those good recluses and Brahmins feel painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, that is, even if they practice the ascetic practices, they're capable of enlightenment, and even if they don't feel these painful, terrible, racking feelings, they're also capable of knowledge and vision and supreme enlightenment. So that is the third simile. Now it seems to me, maybe I'm missing something, but if one takes the logic of these three similes, the point that seems to emerge is that the ascetic practices don't make a difference one way or another. What's important is to withdraw from the physical indulgence and sense pleasures and to quiet or to suppress the sensual desire inside. So that seems to point to an internal discipline rather than the bodily discipline of extreme asceticism. Do you get the same point? So then it would seem to me, this seems like the discovery that the Buddha should have made after practicing the ascetic practices. Then he realizes the ascetic practices are useless. What's necessary is to develop this inner discipline. He's already undertaken the physical withdrawals from sensual pleasures. So what's necessary is to develop the inner mental discipline to abandon sensual desire inwardly. And then that would bring the knowledge and vision and supreme enlightenment. So that seems to be the conclusion, but then, starting with paragraph 20, he begins to undertake this long course of extreme ascetic practices, inflicting a lot of pain and torment on the body. Okay, I'm not going to go through all the ascetic practices. You can read these on your own. But he goes through such extreme practices that we come to the very bottom of page 329. After these long fasts, he says, paragraph 29 here, at the very last line, "Now when people saw me, some said, 'The recluse Gotama is black,'" that's the color of his skin changed because of his fasting. "Other people said, 'He is not black, he's brown.' Some other people thought he's neither black nor brown, but golden skin. So much had the clear, bright color of my skin deteriorated through eating so little." Okay, then he thinks whatever recluses or Brahmins in the past have experienced painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, This is the utmost, the ultimate. There's none beyond this. And so for the future, in the future, so in the present, whatever present ascetics and Brahmins have experienced painful feelings due to their ascetic practices, this is the utmost. There is none beyond this. But by this racking practice of austerities, I have not attained any superhuman states, any distinction or excellence in knowledge and vision worthy of the Aryans, the noble ones. So it seems to me that is the point where we should draw the conclusion, bring in the three similes and draw the conclusion. Okay, then a question comes to his mind. Maybe there is some other path to enlightenment. And then he recollects an incident that took place in his boyhood. Now in the state where he was raised, the Sakyan Republic, it was the custom every year at a certain time of the year they would have the plowing festival. This would be the beginning of the cultivation season. And so his father took him and probably other members of the family, they all went to the fields to plow the fields. And they put him, since he was just a little boy, they put him under a tree. It's called the rose apple tree. Rose apple is a little fruit, very nice little fruit. We don't have it in this country. And then all of them went off to the plowing, to plow the field, and they just left the boy, probably with a nurse, in the shade of the tree. Then while he was sitting there, he just spontaneously crossed his legs, and somehow his attention probably went to the breath, and just spontaneously he entered into a deep meditative state. Here he describes that state quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states. I entered upon and abided in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Could that be the path to enlightenment? Okay, then following by that memory, there came the realization, the understanding that this is indeed the path to enlightenment. Then he thinks, why should I be afraid of that pleasure, since it has nothing to do with sensual pleasures, nothing to do with unwholesome states of mind? Okay, so then he decides to pursue that type of pleasure, but he considers that it's not easy to practice in that way when my body has been so weakened through my fasting. So then he makes a decision to resume eating solid food. And so he probably goes on off round, collects some food, and begins to eat again. And then there were five ascetics, five monks, who were staying with him and attending on him. And when they saw him starting to take food again, they thought that they became disgusted with him, and they thought, now our leader, Gotama, is starting to live luxuriously. He's given up his striving and reverted to luxury. You see, they were very intent on the ascetic practices. They were convinced that this is the true way to enlightenment, and the Buddha hadn't yet reported his understanding to them. It's a little bit strange, he should have told them that they might have stayed with him. But instead he goes and takes starts to take food, and then they get disgusted with him and they leave him. Okay, then when he eats, after he's been resuming the food as his body fills out and he regains his strength, then he starts to practice meditation. He gains the four jhanas, or meditative absorptions. Then, paragraph 38, then he recollects his previous lives, even hundreds and thousands of lives in the past. Then comes the divine eye, paragraph 40, by which he can see beings passing away and taking rebirth in accordance with their karma, and he understands the working of the law of karma. Then paragraph 42, he directs his mind to the knowledge of the destruction of the asavas, the toxic streams of sensual desire, craving for existence and ignorance. Then he arrives at the knowledge of the Four Noble Truths, and when he knows and sees thus, then his mind is liberated from the asava of sensual desire, liberated from the asava of craving for existence, liberated from the asava of ignorance. When it's liberated, there comes the knowledge of liberation, and then he knows birth is destroyed, the spiritual life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there is no more coming back to any state of being, no further rebirth in this samsara. And so the way we have the account given here, at the point where the Buddha sits down on that delightful stretch of ground at Uruvela, it's not that he just immediately goes into deep meditation and it realizes Nibbana, but he undergoes this long process of practicing these austerities, these ascetic practices, till he realizes that they are futile. Then he discovers another way to enlightenment, which is a peaceful and pleasant way. It's what the Buddha calls the middle way, which involves maintaining the health and strength of the body, and instead focusing on developing the mind. So the full middle way is actually the Noble Eightfold Path, but here, since the Buddha had fulfilled, we could say, all the basic requirements, what he focuses on is the right concentration aspect of the Noble Eightfold Path, which is the achievement of the four jhanas, and then based on the four jhanas, practicing insight, and then developing this higher state of knowledge. There are a few things in this traditional story that seem a little peculiar. But first I'll ask whether anybody has any questions at this point. Somebody, I think it was Sunil, you asked an interesting question last week. And I said that question would relate to what's going to come this week, right? I remember.
I was asking about the 6 years which Buddha spent doing this process. And I was thinking the time she spent on the Noble Eightfold Path or right concentration probably was very short. Might have been a few months during the last sixth year.
The way it's presented, it's almost as though it took a few days or not more than a week, just going on Amtrang till he gets his bodily strength back.
Things like, really understand is probably the main Buddhist concept is everything is conditioned.
Yeah.
So I feel that the time which you spent during the first 6 or 5 years or so during the ascetic practices and doing other stuff might have some impact on his final realization.
Yeah.
So that was not totally waste.
Okay, that's a good point. What I would say is that the undertaking of these ascetic practices and carrying them so thoroughly, even to the point of where he says that no ascetic, no Brahmin or ascetic has ever endured so many painful ascetic practices as I have. I think this shows the strength of his determination, his energy, the commitment to his purpose. So all, and that by undertaking those practices, it would have sort of strengthened and reinforced his determination, reinforced his sense of purpose, so that once he discovered what he considered the right way, the proper way, then he would have been able to progress very quickly. So his main problem was not that he looked like a most of us, at least I have to speak for myself, is not that he lacked determination, motivation, energy, patience, vigor, commitment, conviction, all of that he had, because he was able to achieve the highest meditations that his teachers had achieved. He was able to practice these ascetic practices so thoroughly. So he had all of those qualities, determination, conviction, purpose, commitment. All that he was lacking was the insight into what is the right path, what is the correct method. So once he found that correct method, then all of the other factors were already behind him, propelling him quickly through till he could reach the goal.
In a way, the right path was conditioned by the wrong path which he took.
You can say that, yeah. It's not so much the wrong path that conditions the right path, but it's the wrong path helped to strengthen the good qualities of the mind within him. So once he found the right path, then he could progress very rapidly.
I'm sitting here thinking that without direct experience, he wasn't going to know that this wasn't going to work.
His
whole exploration was trying everything until he found the right. But I struggle with the statement, no one else has done this ever as good as I.
Yeah.
And I hear it in other sutras.
Yeah.
And from my experience, it sounds so much like arrogance.
Yeah.
As opposed to another way of stating it. Is it, can you help with that so I can put that down?
Let's just see exactly what he says. It's not quite that he's saying nobody has done it as good as I, but what he's saying is that whatever recluses and Brahmins in the future will, in the past, have experienced painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, this is the utmost. There is none beyond this. I think what he means is that he's followed all of the traditional routes of ascetic practices, each one to its ultimate limit. So it's not so much a personal boasting, saying, I am the best, but like this is the limit of the ascetic practices, because he was pretty much, in fact, at one point, he falls down, and then the deities are observing him, and they say that now he's not yet dead, but he's dying. But some thought he's not dead or dying, but now he's an arahant, in other words, he's enlightened. That is the way that the arahats dwell. The real way is to exhaust oneself through asceticism to the point that one just collapses. What is an arahat? So he pretty much carried those ascetic practices just to the edge of death. So if one carries them a little bit further, then it's the end. It's death.
Are these his words?
Of course, we don't know what is exactly the words of the Buddha himself. What are the words of the compilers of the texts who have based themselves upon accounts of his words? I mean, we have no recordings, there were no written documents during the Buddha's time, things that he would have written himself. So all we have are traditions that have been transmitted for several hundred years before they were put in writing. But statements like this, I would say, pretty much they have very much a living flavor to them compared to some of the other parts of the text which seem almost mechanical in their formulation.
The other question is that since he discovered the method, does that make it easier for us? Since he discovered the method, does that make it easier for us, or does that mean that we too have to strive in different ways?
No, it makes it much, much easier, because the point to discover the method is to sort of short-circuit all of the experimentation that he had to do himself. It doesn't mean that it makes it easy. It makes it easier for us. Yeah, please.
To the person who was, what's your name?
Susie.
Hi, Dre. If you read about the account of the life of St. Francis of Assisi, he also practiced severe austerities, almost to the point of death, almost to the ruination of his health, and this is a Christian perspective.
Yeah.
And he realized hurting his sister, the body, was not the way. That's how he put it. This is not the way. You could have said that he took it to the utmost degree, because he really did almost croak. And he just realized that's not the way to God, to Jesus, and his path.
That was not my question. It's the statement, St. Francis, I am of a Christian tradition.
So you know about it.
It's the way the statement is presented.
Well, there's a lot of that.
St. Francis doesn't say, I took it to the utmost, and constantly hear it repeated. And I'm starting to think it was his people who added that dimension, because they were so proud of him.
It could be,
That's how it feels more and more.
It could be,
And also, in the Christian tradition, it's almost the opposite. We're supposed to suffer like Jesus, and suffering is held high to demonstrate that you're living like Jesus, rather than Buddha saying, suffering's already here, you don't have to add it to your life.
Yeah.
I'm teaching a way to alleviated.
Yeah.
And I'm running into my own upbringing conflict with.
But the point with the Buddhist practice is that, in India during the Buddhist time, the widespread conviction was that a way to liberate.
To beat oneself.
It's not beating oneself. It's not tormenting oneself in the sense of punishing oneself. So to call it self-punishment is wrong. The idea is that not to punish the body, but the physical body is considered in some way an obstacle to the emergence of the flowering of the spirit.
Or even it is wicked because it holds these
two. It's not considered wicked.
That's the Christian view.
Maybe in the Christian,
notion probably he had to say that, because if he didn't, the chorus of Brahmin ascetics would be so universal, saying, He can't know what he's talking about, because we all know that it's asceticism that leads to enlightenment, you know, and he hasn't done the full course.
Yeah.
So I think that in order to establish a religion or, you know, a following, he had to make that claim.
Yeah, yeah. What I would say, it's not so much that he had to make the claim, though apparently he did.
Oh, he had to do it.
He had to do it, yeah. He had to carry these ascetic practices to the limit in order to both convince himself that they don't work, and also it's a way of convincing others, his contemporaries, that they don't work.
So far as he could see, it was asceticism that led as far as anybody went.
Yeah.
And I'm sure he believed that until the moment when he thought, I'm actually killing myself and it's not helping.
Yeah.
He believed it.
Can I just ask the order of events?
Yeah.
First teacher, second teacher, asceticism?
That's the way it's presented in the text, yeah. With the first two teachers, apparently they didn't recommend an extreme ascetic regimen, but they taught meditative disciplines, purely meditative disciplines. This is something also that seems a little bit strange. You know, from a Buddhist perspective, we would say that they were already following a middle way. Maybe it was a different meditative path than the one the Buddha eventually devised. But they weren't indulging in the extreme ascetic practices. So how does the Buddha credit himself as being the one who discovers the middle way? It seems a little peculiar. Also, another thing seems a little peculiar. The way it's presented in the text, for 6 years he practiced these ascetic practices. And then it seems when he discovers this other path to enlightenment, it all seems to go very quickly. He just gets his health back. Then there's an account that on the last day, a cowherd girl presents him with a food offering of the rice pudding, which he eats. And then after eating, bathing, then he sits down under the Bodhi tree, crosses the legs, makes the determination, I won't get up till my mind is liberated, and then everything happens the course of that night. But then when he starts teaching, we have so many teachings on different types of meditation, detailed explanations of four foundations of mindfulness, so many detailed analyses of five aggregates, sense bases, elements, unwholesome states, different groups of defilements, and so on. It just seems to me a little bit puzzling that all of this could have been understood in such a short time. And also a little bit strange that it would take 6 years to figure out that ascetic practices don't work. In my days of youthful folly, I experimented with them a little bit. And I realized that, you know, maybe I didn't have the strength and will and determination, but it took like about 3 days of fasting to realize that this ain't going to work. Okay, I think Treya, you had... that's a part? Treya? Drea, okay.
Sure, it's occurred to me, and if you, the Buddha comes off differently in different suttas.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, you're the guy who's read all of them, but just even in my limited reading, some of the suttas, and I couldn't tell you which ones were which, strike me as a young Buddha.
Yeah.
As enlightened. But you know, he doesn't have maturity yet. Other ones, when he's, you know, when you actually know he's older, because he's with Ananda, because he is older with Ananda, he seems he seems to know more. He seems to be, in some ways, more relaxed, just more, you know.
Yeah.
I've not seen him as more enlightened, but it's just, well, you get to be a better teacher as you teach.
Yeah.
You know? That's just natural.
Yeah.
So he gets the aha moment at, what, 32, 30-something?
It's supposed to be 35. Yeah.
Okay, 35. And he goes and teaches. I mean, his style changes. I mean, what was his first sort of lesson? You know, he meets the, you know, that guy and was like, wow, you look great, who's your teacher? I am the all-enlightened one.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, right. And then, you know, I think he, you know, he learns. He becomes, and maybe he discovers other things. You know, he appears to have gone through the jhanas and then has realized enlightenment. But then later on, he talks about, you know, you can be a dry insight meditator. You don't have to have the jhanas.
Yeah.
That's nice, but there's another way.
Yeah.
And maybe he just, he learns more things as he goes along.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sure, but it doesn't necessarily get written, you know, written down.
That's
just how it strikes me, is he matures as a teacher.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And the Buddha's teaching career does span something like 45 years.
And there's one other point about the asceticism. That is, he has to also define himself against Mahavira. Because Mahavira...
Wait, he has to define himself?
He has to define himself against
Mahavira. Oh, against Mahavira.
Yeah, the Jains. Exactly. Mahavira has an almost identical biography.
Yeah.
And goes through all, you know, similar sequence, comes to a lot of the same conclusions, except the Jains actually do starve themselves to death. You know, with the Jains, you've got like 29 steps in a hierarchy of purity. And the final one is, you starve yourself to death.
Yeah, that is the Jain.
You know, he has to repudiate that in order to be, in order to have a separate...
Yeah, that's exactly so. Yeah. And I don't think it was here, but he was in a class, recent class in Bodhi Monastery. I pointed out when the Buddha is criticizing the Brahmins, it's done with a kind of, I mean, sometimes he lampoons them a bit, but there's a certain degree of respect and admiration for the Brahmins. Sometimes he's like comparing the Brahmins of today to the Brahmins of old. But even when he's critical of them, there's still a kind of feeling of friendly respect. But when the Buddhist texts run up against the Jains, and then another contemporary teacher called Makali Gosala, who was in some way maybe an offshoot of Jainism, they really bear down, hit hard on the Jains and hard on Makali Gosala. So I can say that there's some sense of a sense of rivalry there. Yes?
The impression that I got was that the Buddha wasn't saying that asceticism was wrong, but just that he saw it as a means to an end. Maybe I'm interpreting it wrong, that it seems like the ascetics see it as an end in itself, you know, you doing it right, something like you were saying about the Jains and everything. But the impression I was getting was that through the three similes, that asceticism can help you get to the point where you can have that inner discipline, which is really what you need to get to. So it seems like he did the ascetic path.
Yeah.
Got to the point where he realized the real thing he needed to do was the inner discipline. So he didn't need the ascetic path anymore. So am I interpreting that wrong, that he was seeing the ascetic?
I would say definitely that the Buddha rejects this path of extreme asceticism as part of his own system of training. Because when he gives his first discourse to the five ascetics, he says, there are two things that should not be pursued by one who has gone forth from the world. One of these is indulgence in sensual pleasures, which is ordinary, common, worldly, doesn't lead to enlightenment. And then the second extreme is self-mortification or self-torment, which he says it's painful, not Aryan, not noble, and doesn't bring benefit, doesn't bring enlightenment. So definitely he rejects the extreme ascetic path, though he'll include a certain degree of, we might call, a wholesome asceticism within his own training, you know, living simply, possessing the minimum of material possessions, being content with what one has, being patient under difficult conditions, but not the deliberate infliction of pain and misery on the body itself. Ravi, did you?
The two teachers whom he encountered, the first two, although they were not, they didn't go into extreme
ascetism,
they had not attained enlightenment.
Oh, I mean, that is known, they hadn't reached the
enlightenment. Although they have even claimed that they attained enlightenment.
Excuse me?
Although they have even claimed that they were enlightened.
Yeah.
The two of them had not really attained enlightenment, although they may
They hadn't achieved the enlightenment that the Buddha was looking for. They had reached certain high levels of meditation, which they might have taken to be enlightenment. But the Buddha, from his perspective, those states were not the enlightenment. But coming to mentioning the two teachers, this is another thing that strikes me as a little peculiar. And I've never been able to figure this out. It was a question that came to my mind, I think even before I went to Sri Lanka to become a monk, maybe back when I started to read about the life of the Buddha, maybe early 1970s. Okay, he learns from these two teachers the state, meditation of nothingness, meditation of neither perception nor non-perception. In the Buddhist training, one is the seventh stage of meditation, the other is the eighth. Now one would suppose that to follow the normal sequence, to get there one would have to go through first jhana, second, third, fourth jhana, then to the fifth stage, then to the sixth stage, then one comes to the seventh stage, the stage of nothingness, and the eighth stage of neither perception nor non-perception. Okay, now after the Bodhisattva has undergone all of these ascetic practices, he starts thinking, I'm not getting anywhere this way. Can there be another way to enlightenment? Now one would think what would come to his mind would be a fairly recent memory, 6 years ago, practicing meditation under the teachers, two teachers. He could have thought of the first jhana there. Not only the first jhana, but the second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. And then he could have realized that's the way to enlightenment. The mistake is just to go beyond the fourth jhana into the formless meditations, where you're in a state of very remote abstraction. And so why don't he just recollect the experience under these two teachers and then take off from them, from those meditations, into the development of insight, and then see that is the way. Instead of going back to this childhood sort of chance experience of the first jhana, what is the answer?
Excuse me?
Yeah. Somebody has it. Let's see who has an answer. Okay, Sunil.
I just wanted to add that according to some of the Hindu meditation traditions, when you start meditation, you straight away, your first attainment is nothingness. Mm. So it doesn't go through a first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. And you straight away go to nothingness. So the idea of that nothingness is not the same as the nothingness which you find on the Buddhist meditation experience. Mm.
That's a possible answer, that the teachers that the Bodhisattva studied with didn't teach a step-by-step way to go possible that they didn't teach the step-by-step process of going through each of the jhanas, then to the base of infinite space, base of infinite consciousness, then to the base of nothingness. Even though in the Buddhist training, in order to get into these formless meditations, one goes through each jhana in turn, overcomes it, goes on to the next, then to the base of space, infinite space, base of infinite consciousness, base of nothingness, then to the base of neither perception or non-perception. But possibly they taught kind of meditation that would just take one straight away into the base of nothingness, base of neither perception nor non-perception. Okay, I think Drea has something.
I was going to say, also the texts don't go into details of how each of the two teachers taught.
Yeah.
They don't go into this great explanation.
Yeah.
It just says, the ultimate is,
yeah.
The Buddha was calling it the first immaterial state and the second immaterial state.
Yeah.
Even though maybe your teacher teaches, I'm going to teach you how to get to the base of nothingness, there's still probably stages you have to go through. Maybe the Buddha's unique in that he was like, I can put a name to these states. Maybe he noticed these different discrete states
that's very
interesting. And decided to I'll make it easy, like a step-by-step instruction.
Yeah.
That's one of the things about Buddhism, which I used to love Taoism, it's fabulous, but there's not a lot of instruction on what to do.
Yeah.
The Buddha really here, it's almost like a cookbook.
Yeah, very much.
Here are the instructions that you need to
hear your
thing. And to just further maybe clarify my earlier point, when I said his teachings grew and matured, and this is just my thought, but I think that even though one becomes enlightened, it doesn't mean one doesn't continue to learn
and
realize things.
Yeah.
So I think his knowledge just accrued and his teachings just got better.
Yeah, I think the way probably it's quite possible that, of course, when he achieves enlightenment, then he realizes everything that's essential to the enlightenment, but still there would be the matter of what we call pedagogical skills, teaching skills, which would be something that he could have learned over his career as a teacher, picking up more skills, more
insight.
Different ways to present the path. Yeah.
I always thought that he went back to the child.
Yeah.
And again, this is covered by my Christian upbringing.
Yeah.
Jesus saying you must become like a little child.
Yeah, that's a good way.
Because I think there's so much, not that the traditions are the same, but all these religious traditions are seemingly looking for some way out. But that he was demonstrating in reaching back there that he realized that there is a simplicity involved in when we make it so complicated. And we teach it as if it can only be done if you do go through the first jhana and the second, and the intellectualizing of it. For me, this is hopeful.
Yeah.
It creates the possibility that those of us, myself included, who aren't doing this extraordinarily extreme mental seeking of information from all the texts and following them to such an intimate degree might slip in by being committed with the innocence of really trying without having to know more. Child images.
I'm laughing because you say you go back to the innocence of a child, just starting with the child's mind. But
simplicity. I meant more simplicity.
Yeah, but I'm remembering days that I was living in Sri Lanka. Sometimes I would go into the city Colombo, and there was a monastery in Colombo where I would stay. It's called Vajiraramma. And on Sundays, they have the equivalent of a Sunday school. You know, the children come, and but there, because it's warm, they hold the classes out in the courtyard. And I'm sitting in my room, and there's a class with these young boys and girls, might be 12, 13 years old. I'm doing some reading in my rooms. Then I hear, let's see how it goes. Vitakka vichara piti sukha citta. tas ekakatam bhaktamam janam. That's, they're reciting the factors of the first jhana, then it goes vichara mattam piti sukacittas ekakatam dutiyam janam. Just mental examination, joy, happiness, one-pointedness of mind, that's the second jhana. Then piti sukha cittas ekagatam tatiyam jhana. Then I went to see this older monk who was staying in his room, and he's sort of boiling. It's like, this is what they're teaching these young children. They have to learn. 12-year-old kids, they have to learn the formula for their jhanas. In a language they don't understand, of us.
I was taught to memorize the Baltimore Catechism. That's the same thing you're saying. It's how we teach a tradition can destroy it for the individual who is being forced to learn it. And when we make it methodical, memorizable, etc., and we're not teaching it from so understanding in heart, it's very easy to turn away from. Buddha didn't have anybody making him sit there and recite that. He was sitting under a tree looking at some ants.
But also generations of monks had recited them. But there were other things that were devised for teaching little girls, young girls, boys and girls. Somebody else said something. Your name again was?
Abraham.
Yes.
Abraham is good. Could it be that with these couple of suttas that we looked at, that the teaching is about not following a particular defined path of someone else, but to constantly, it seems, to come back to oneself and to look for the real path, I guess, like the other two teachers that he eventually leaves behind, and constantly going back and looking for himself, and then with the child going back to the his youth experience, again it's going back inside for what was real to him, and go from that. So it seems that all along is about abandoning, abandoning the teaching, that is taking the teaching and then abandoning it and going back to oneself. So,
yeah, this is a very good point, but I think it has to be looked at from two angles. Okay, one angle is that probably the reason why even if the Buddha, suppose he had learned the jhanas under the two teachers, but if he recollected an experience under those two teachers, then he couldn't say that the path is entirely something that he's brought up himself, that he's hammered out or devised himself based on his own experience. And so by taking the discovery of the path back to his own childhood experience, then it makes the path something which has evolved from the Buddha himself. So this becomes a completely new path breaking out on the Indian spiritual scene. Okay, that is one comment that I wanted to make. The other comment is that, like, once the Buddha discovers the path, then the point is that we don't have to undertake the long course of experimenting to find at least the broad contours of the path. We could say the path and its broad contours is something taught, laid out by the Buddha. But we still do have to do some experimenting, because there are many different ways of, you know, practicing the path, many different, say, meditation techniques, combinations of techniques, many different defilements, and then different remedies for those defilements. So we still have to experiment on ourselves to find out what works for us. But the basic, say, the structure or scheme of the path and the whole range of aspects of the path, that is something that is originally taught by the Buddha, so that we could find ourselves within that range as a starting point. Okay, I want to take some of the questions that come from the internet. Okay, the Buddha's childhood jhana experience was very different from the so-called jhana experience he got from his two teachers. Does that mean his middle way to attain jhana is unique to Buddhism? Okay, under the two teachers, there's no mention about learning what we call the first, second, third, fourth jhanas. What he learned from the two teachers was the base of nothingness, base of neither perception nor non-perception. Whether the four jhanas are completely unique to Buddhism, this I don't know. There could be counterparts to the jhanas in other meditative systems, but called by different names. Of course, the names first, second, third, fourth jhana might be unique to Buddhism, but if one practices a method that will bring one to the same level of concentration, it can be the same as the jhana. Second question, was there any mention of how the Buddha attained stream entry in the sutta? Was he already a once-returner? So Majjhima number 26 only describes his final journey to full liberation. The way it's presented in the text, the Buddha went through, it doesn't even speak about the Buddha going through the stages of stream entry, once-returning, non-returning, and arhatship. It just speaks about him on the night of his enlightenment going all the ways to arhatship, but no mention of any intermediate stages. And it seems that he couldn't be a stream enterer before he started his quest for enlightenment, because a stream enterer would have the idea, what is the path to enlightenment, whereas the Buddha has to, the Bodhisattva has to discover it for himself. Okay, there are some meditation teachers who warn students about becoming attached to the joy of jhana, especially teachers of the dry insight schools. Isn't this contradicted by Majjhima Nikaya number 36? I say what's contradicted by Majjhima Nikaya number 36 is the idea that some teachers of the dry insight school say is that one shouldn't attain jhana because you might get attached to the joy. Wait, this gets to be a little complicated. Let me see if I can deal with the other questions quickly first. When do true disenchantment and dispassion arise? What are their causes? Is deep meditation required? It seems that all ascetics already feel that even if they are fearless, even if they are not on the right path to Nibbana. Okay, true, what's called disenchantment and dispassion are said to arise in the true deep sense out of deep insight. So the knowledge and vision of things as they truly are is the cause for the arising of disenchantment and dispassion. So even though those ascetics might have already become disenchanted with worldly life, but they hadn't reached that experiential insight level that brings the liberating disenchantment. Okay, there is a new age trend to say that all religions are basically practicing the same thing. Is Buddhist samatha, vipassana meditation, really the same as the meditations of Hinduism, Jainism, Christian, Kabbalah, etc.? Again, this gets to be a rather big question. It's almost a question that needs a little bit like a lecture to handle. So I'll just pass over this one and come back to this one also. It's a little complicated. This is about attachment to the joy of jhana. Okay, what I would say is that there are different paths of practice within the Buddhist fold. So some paths emphasize going directly into insight, others emphasize the path of jhana. The way the Buddha presents his own discovery of the path, it includes the jhanas up to the fourth jhana. And the way I see it is because for the Buddha to achieve full enlightenment as a Buddha, he has to achieve at least the three knowledges, the recollection of past lives, the divine eye by which he sees how beings pass away and take rebirth according to their karma, and then he has to reach full arhatship through the elimination of the asavas. And so to gain all three knowledges, the usual secure foundation is the fourth jhana. And so the Buddha has to go through and master the four jhanas before he develops wisdom. Okay, I've heard some dry insight teachers say that one shouldn't practice the jhanas. They're very dangerous because you can experience joy through them, joy and happiness, and then you become attached to that joy and happiness. That would be, I would say, wrong instructions. What I would say is that what's proper, a dry insight teacher could say that there is a path of dry insight which doesn't involve the jhanas. If one feels inclined to the path of jhana, one should follow that way. But don't become, even a teacher of jhana will say, don't become attached to the joy, but don't cling to it, but experience it, then let it go to go further. But what's important to know is that the way the Buddha structures his path, he uses higher types of happiness and pleasure as an inducement to overcome grosser types of happiness and pleasure. And so normally we find happiness and pleasure in sense enjoyments. And so the Buddha will use the happiness of the jhana, even the happiness of lower levels of meditation, as a way to help us overcome the attachment to sensual enjoyment. Then, suppose somebody achieves the first jhana, then the Buddha will say, the pleasure and happiness of the first jhana is relatively gross. Abandon it and go on to the second jhana. And this way, he'll lead them through third jhana, fourth jhana, even to the formless meditations. And at some point, he'll say, even the pleasure of samadhi is gross. The pleasure of insight is better, superior. And then he'll teach how to overcome the jhanas through the practice of insight. And so finally, at the last stage, he'll say, even the pleasure of insight is gross. The pleasure or happiness of nibbana is superior. Then when the person achieves nibbana, then they'll know for themselves that there's no happiness or pleasure superior to that. Okay, so that's the way I would understand the relation. And also what is true, at least from my experience with dry insight meditation, is that it also gives rise to very intense joy and happiness. It's not that we use the word dry, but it brings a lot of, when the mind really gets well concentrated through insight, it brings a lot of happiness and joy. But then if one becomes attached to that joy of insight, then what starts to come down. And so in order to progress further, even on the path of insight, one has to let go of one's attachment to the joy. And as one lets go of each level of attachment to joy, it brings deeper, fuller, more satisfying levels of joy. Okay, I think we'll have, okay, we'll take one question then.
How does no self for you?
Say the question.
How does no self fit into this?
How does no self fit into this? Well, actually, no self pertains to the stage of insight knowledges. But in this sutta, in both suttas, there's no mention of not self because it's not dealing with what the Buddha actually realized through insight.
I don't understand what also working with another teacher who's asked me to look at the experience from the point of view of five aggregates to see if there is self. And to look at life in terms of its illusory qualities.
In terms of what?
The illusory qualities?
Yeah, yeah.
So that who is experiencing the time? Obviously there is some node there that has to get enlightened, and your and mine and everybody's node is different.
Yeah, but I think we have to keep. I think we have to keep the questions pertaining to the material that I'm covering. A couple of weeks ago, I dealt in a lot of detail with the teaching of non-self. Actually, I think almost two whole classes I dealt with non-self. I think if they're put up on the internet on this Ustream TV. It was in relation to sutta number 22.
Thank you.
Not the first class on that. There could have been the second and the third classes. The second part of the second class, and then I think the third class was almost entirely on non-self. If we come to, in fact, we'll come to non-self when I take sutta number 28. Then you'll get another chance. The next sutta after this is number 28. But if you play hooky, then you come once in a while and say, what's non-self? Okay, we end with the sharing of the merits. Then before this, I should mention next week, no class. That's the 22nd. Next class will be the Saturday after that, the 29th. So we'll come back to this sutta and try to finish this sutta next time. Okay, so we'll end by sharing the merits. Okay, just mention after the 29th, then I'll have a class June 5th. Not June 12th, I'll be away June 12th. June 19th, we'll have a class.
Will you send an email on?
Excuse me?
Will you send out those?
Yeah. I'll have them put up on the website and also sent as mail. Has everybody who's attended given their email address? If you haven't, you could write it on this piece of paper, and then I'll give it to Kaiti to put on the registration list. Okay, then we'll have discussion after lunch, unless is there a lot of work, are people going to be doing a lot of work? And I have to mention before we go also, tomorrow, a very important day here. Tomorrow is what's called Vaisak Day. This is the celebration of the enlightenment, the birth, enlightenment, and passing away of the Buddha. So today we're studying about the enlightenment, but, you know, I'm a very boring fellow, so I don't celebrate things. I just explain. But to really have the joy of life, of celebration, you come tomorrow, there will be some chanting. You get the chance to bathe the Buddha tomorrow. Only once a year you get that opportunity. You get the little statue of the newborn Buddha, and then everybody gets into the lines, and it'll come up, and it'll be in a bowl of scented water with flowers, and then everybody gets a chance to bathe the newborn Buddha. And then there'll be super lunch tomorrow, so don't eat breakfast tomorrow. You want to keep a good appetite, so you can try all of the different delicacies, Chinese, maybe Vietnamese and other types of delicacies. And then probably in the afternoon there'll be some shows, entertainment, singing, dancing, what do they have?
It's going to be a magic guy doing a magic act. And I think
yeah.
It's going to be a bouncy castle.
A what?
A bouncy castle. The big inflatable thing you bounce around in.
Oh. Yeah, so please make it a point. What time does the ceremony begin? I think it begins night. Usually they begin about 10 o'clock in the morning. Okay, so tomorrow you get a chance to learn what the Buddha's enlightenment is really like for the Buddhist world, not the way these stuffy intellectuals discuss it from a book. No, that's not the way. Okay, so we end with sharing the merits. Akasata jabumata deva naga mahitika punyanta nanumodipa shiram rakantu sasanam. Akasata jabumata deva naga mahitika punyanta nanumodipa shiram rakantu desanam. Akasata jabumata deva naga mahitika punyanta nanumodipa shiram rakantu mam param. Etavata ca mehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya bhavagupadhaya vichihetato etam tere satakayupapanna rupiya rupicha sanya sanino dukha pamuchantu pusantu nibhutin. Okay, then we end with three half bows.